Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
What's good, internet? This is Austin Walker coming to you from Waypoint Radio. I almost said coming to you live again, but I didn't say it.
So now that means the joke's like started on Friday, went back to Monday, and now is now Tuesday? Referenced again on Tuesday. Yes. Oh, the timeline on this is just...
Joining me, Patrick Klefik, Danielle Riendo.
Hi.
We are here to talk about a story that just went up on the old waypoint.vice.com website.
Yeah.
I don't know what the headline of that story is yet because we're talking about it before it went
well,
up.
I know what the headline is now. We could say... Right. I don't know that the headline... that's the sort of neither here nor there.
Patrick, you wrote the story.
Yeah, a little while ago, gained access to a bunch of documents related to United Front Games, which was responsible for probably one of the most underrated open world games of the last 10 years. Like a real, I think when you say the terms cult classic, I think Sleeping Dogs falls into that basket. They went they went out of business. I'm not sure of like the exact like. Status of that studio and whether everyone's been laid off. Basically, United Front Games does not exist anymore as of October. And a little while ago, I was passed on a bunch of documents related to a planned sequel for Sleeping Dogs 2, which was sort of actively in a pitch and pre-production phase back in 2013. The timeline for that is around the time when developers were still talking about PlayStation 4 and Xbox One as... Durante and Orbis.
Durango.
Durango, not Durante.
Durango.
Where am I get Durante from?
Is Durante a boss in a fighting game?
It must
Durante...
be.
Durante.
It's gotta be a Street Fighter character.
Yeah. Yeah, or something like
know.
That.
Oh, Durante's like the guy. I'm not even gonna get into it. It's not worth explaining. But in my head, I know where I pulled it from, which is fine.
Okay, we'll talk later.
But we, It's a ton. I mean, hundreds of documents sort of explaining like a snapshot of where United Front Games was in terms of pitching this to Square Enix, who owns the rights to Sleeping Dogs. Like, if people remember, Sleeping Dogs was technically the third entry in the True Crime series from Activision.
Yes.
Back when they made True Crime Streets of L.A., True Crime. I think it was just New York.
New York City. I think it was New York City.
Yeah.
I liked that game a lot, and in retrospect, it does not hold up.
and then the third entry in that was supposed to be Hong Kong, made by United Front Games. They ended up dropping it as Activision was kind of getting out of, I guess what you would call like sort of B-tier games, which is not meant to be derogatory as much as it is like, you know, there's a certain class of game and sort of like production value that is Grand Theft Auto. I always use like games like Singularity as like a good example of like, it's a great game, but it's not, you know, in a certain class in terms of production and budget and mostly sales expectations. So that went off. Square Enix bought the rights to it, renamed it Sleeping Dogs. And so we have this article up that kind of walks through what Sleeping Dogs 2 was possibly going to be. It got up until pretty deep into the pre-production phase, and then it was formally pitched to Square. Square passed on it, and then a lot of sort of the meta elements of the game about how they were going to handle their open world were brought into Triad Wars, which was a huge
free-to-play version of Sleeping Dogs.
A game no one wanted. And by all accounts that United Front Games did not want to make, but was kind of their way of salvaging what Sleeping Dogs 2 was as a pitch. And then also the fact that the studio was kind of deeply investing in the idea of free-to-play at the time, as were a lot of studios.
That's the thing, one of the striking things for me about this story and about the pitch documents that we had was that and with the fact that it ended up being Triad Wars, or like part of Triad Wars, yeah. was that they both reflect fads at the time, and so the pitch documents have a lot of these like mobile, like second screen experiences, some like mobile gaming stuff. Triad Wars tried to do the free to play thing, and like, God, Sleeping Dogs deserves better than that. Like,
yes.
It feels like, and this is not, I'm not saying that this is what the thought process was, but it feels like the thought process was like, how do we take this thing that we know is good and make it successful and make it like profitable when it's like on its face is just already a dope, good one of these games. One of the best of these games that have come out, like you said, in the last decade. And it just sucks. Just like it just couldn't succeed on its own merits, I guess. Or the costs were too high. Like, we don't know why Square passed on that specific pitch and why it was retooled into Triad Wars. But it, no matter how you shake it out, like it's just a bummer that we just didn't get that game.
Yeah, Sleeping Dogs had so much character to it.
Yeah.
Like it was just, it was a funny game. It was a weird game. It took place in a part of the world that wasn't New York, San Francisco, you know, like.
But it also had an insider vibe. Like, it didn't come across like.
It wasn't like white guy going to Hong Kong and fish out of water, right?
Right, right. In fact, it was very much about a guy from Hong Kong who had to deal with the fact that his perspective on Hong Kong had shifted and that he wasn't part of the same parts of the community that he used to be. A very, like, internal focused game, which is really cool and like you said, funny, charming, dark when it needed to be dark, very a flexible game for a flexible time.
And it definitely I had a lot of really, really good experiences streaming it. And it was actually one of the earlier games in my own sort of life of streaming. And I have a lot of queer sort of people who like to watch my streams, and there were a lot of dudes who were like, he is really hot. And I don't mean to make this sound like, you know, I only want to talk about who's hot in games, but it was like a really cool thing. It was a really cool thing to see an East Asian guy who was presented as like macho and hot and like a
competent.
Sexy dude who's confident and like, you know, walks around, he's got a great butt. And like people were actually talking about this in my chat about like, you know, so often in games, like East Asian dudes are seen as like not as masculine or sort of not as macho. And there's this whole sort of like gross stereotype in that way about it. And this was like really big for some people. Yeah. They were really super into that sort of.
Or like it goes the other way where it's like, oh, if you're East Asian, you're either like the nerdy tech guy or you're Bruce Lee.
Yeah, and or obviously you're just this guy a ninja, was, like a
faceless. Or you're a ninja, right,
kinda,
right,
you know.
Exactly. Yeah. So obviously this guy was a martial arts expert, but one of the things that happens when you set a game in a place like Hong Kong is there are lots of East Asian characters in that game, and so you end up with a diversity of potential reads. Like, oh, it turns out there's lots of different people in East Asia. There's lots of types of people in Hong Kong, just like there's lots of types of people everywhere.
Yeah.
It's one of the reasons why, not to bring it back again to Watch Dogs 2, but I'm glad that there are multiple black characters in the same way that I'm glad that there are multiple female characters. Like, oh, that's one way that you can address the problem of feeling like you're creating a stereotype is by increasing the amount of people from different backgrounds. I think Sleeping Dogs did that super well. Like, there was such a cool range of different types of characters, and obviously that's not an automatic solution every time, but it was handled really well in that game.
Yeah, and the setting for Sleeping Dogs 2 sounded like it was going to be, like, again, it was going to be set in China,
right.
And, like, I can't, you know, what other game is going to go and simulate open world China, like they were talking about in the documents, you know, making sure that like all the local dialects were represented, and like they would, you know, and that was one thing that like, you know, Sleeping Dogs did really well. Like, you just kind of felt, even though it was like this, you know, this exaggerated version of a Hong Kong city, that they handled it with a care that still feels like you have you're a part of that world. And so it would have been fascinating to see them apply that to another part of the world that. It's just hard to imagine other Western developers really touching on. Like, it's going to shock me if they're, you know, I would love if something like Watch Dogs decided to go to somewhere like China, but it, you know, it seems more likely Watch Dogs is going to go to London than it's going to go to China.
Sure.
You know, it's just, they had a lot of really ambitious ideas for Sleeping Dogs too. There, so we kind of outlined a couple of them in the article, but you know, it was, you know, it's kind of confusing whether it was going to be sort of like a fully single player co-op game, like the co-op stuff. It sounds like they hadn't really settled on what it was going to be, whether it was a thing that you were going to be able to play co-op, but whether, you know, there were two characters being set up, and the story was going to split and you were going to be able to play as both of them, how that would have worked with the actual sort of co-op mechanics, it was kind of unclear. But there was that, like, their second screen experience actually sounded kind of fascinating. Whether it actually worked out in the way they pitched, I don't know. But, you know, they were talking about using the cloud saves of people's of games to create sort of aggregate data for the amount of crime in different parts of the city.
Right.
So sort of like in an MMO, like let's say PlanetSide is a good example of this, where like you can all go attack certain areas of the world and like turn it onto your side. Now,
right,
that happens in a game where everyone's playing in the same world together. They were calling it massively single player, which is like taking these elements of MMOs, bringing them into the single player. So it's like, well, if the community decides, all right, we're going to take this part back in the northeastern part of the city, we're taking that back from X gang.
Right.
If the whole community had to work towards that, and then it aggregated the data from cloud saves. Again, I don't know if they could have done the cloud saves, but they could have done server data and gotten something in that direction.
Well, one, that also reflects that they didn't necessarily know where things were at with the then upcoming next gen consoles.
Correct, yeah.
Like, because obviously the cloud was a big question mark for a long time. Like, is this going to be Drivatars? What is this going to be? but it does remind me of just like world tendency in Demon's Souls, right?
Yeah.
Where it's like, oh, right, the whole community can get together to work towards this really obtuse thing.
Hold on. World tendency is only in Demon's Souls.
Okay, I can't just say world tendency and people understand what I'm talking about.
And you can, like me, have played through the entirety of Demon's Souls and not even know what world tendency is because the game doesn't actually explain it or how the mechanics of it work.
Understand that I first played Demon's Souls in Japanese, figuring out what world tendency was then was even weirder.
So you should explain, because it is a really fascinating concept, and it's easy to understand why they ditched it, but what actually it is, you should probably
So the way
elaborate.
World tendency worked in Demon's Souls is that there was a kind of a range from pure white to pure black, and it was like the aggregate of the way people were playing the game in their own personal saves. There was a bunch of things that could shift it from white to black or from black to white or from neutral or whatever. And depending on which side it was on, different things would happen. So if it was black world tendency, enemies have higher HP and attack power. They also have more souls. They have like more XP that you could get. And there'd be additional like super tough NPCs all over the place. And the way that you could change it was like, oh, if you kill a boss, it shifts towards white. But if you die or if you kill certain other bosses, it shifts back towards black, depending on like if there were like certain optional bosses, stuff like that. If you died in certain ways, it would shift back towards black. But if you killed an invader, it would shift back towards white. And so the community was able to like push and pull on it in certain times where it was like, oh, you'll get extra XP if it's for white tendency or whatever it would be. Or, like, here's a special thing that will happen this weekend. Like, oh, we'll have a black tendency weekend.
Certain locations that you couldn't get
Yes, totally. That's absolutely amazing. True. Yeah. There definitely were, or like drops that would only happen during a pure black world tendency. Stuff like that, which is like really cool and ahead of its time and completely obtuse and bad. Like, I love it, but it's also stupid.
It's a great idea, but again, like, it's, you know, yeah, it's sort of like, you know, poise. It's like it's a really interesting mechanic that is not outlined, and so instead you have to like read facts and message boards to understand how to use it, and sometimes From Software has really great ideas that it kind of buries in ways
I think that there's definitely something there for like thinking about the way that sort of massively single player stuff works. Presumably Sleeping Dogs 2, if this pitch had gone forward, would have been a little bit more upfront with like, oh, hey, this is why you're doing this, because they were kind of positioning it in these documents as being a big pitch to feel connected, not just across actual co-op, but with everybody else all around the world. And then the other thing was like the mobile game was supposed to tie into that too, where you were basically a cop who was assigning resources to address those sorts of things and like sending extra police squads to the areas where the crime was and stuff like that. So
yeah, so like, you know, if you summoned a helicopter to monitor the area in the mobile game, like on your bus ride home, when you logged into the game on your console or on your PC, you would see like that increased helicopter presence in the game.
That's the pitch anyway. Again, like it just didn't happen. One of my favorite, most interesting things was this notion of procedural campaigns for co-op, that like one of the challenges that they outline in these documents is that the it's tough to make co-op stuff matter because what if someone wants to drop out? What if someone can only play for a little bit? What if, like, is there the save? Is that going to go across both people's things? Does someone not want to be the co-op character and instead wants to be Wei? And so, like, you can't. So there are all these things. And one of the solutions that they proposed for it was this notion of, like, a procedurally generated mission campaign, like a little mini campaign where it would, like, pull from all of these different possible questions and scenarios and kind of build with building blocks a little kind of little mini mission structure of a couple of missions where you're investigating a crime or you're going after a mob boss or whatever. And one of the coolest things about it was that there's a chance that it could have a twist in it. So, like, you could start off the mission structure with you and your co-op friend investigating a corrupt politician or something and figuring out, like, oh, where are they taking the money from or whatever. And then in the middle of that campaign, there could be a twist, like the politician ends up dead. And so now the mission isn't about investigating the politician anymore. It's about investigating the murder. And that sort of stuff is really cool and could have been really unique. It could have also just been really paint by numbers and bad. Like, execution is a hell of a thing. It's tough to stick the landing sometimes. But ideas like that are so much more exciting to me than, like, some of the other stuff in here, which is just like, oh, you could punch people until they fall into glass now instead of just grabbing them and throwing them into glass, you know?
Major change.
Oh, that stuff is appreciated, but...
Yeah, and what's interesting about reading these documents, and part of the reason, you know, I think it's interesting to talk about this game and to show people these documents is the granularity. Is, like, you take that difference in the sequel for granted because it just happens, but actually seeing all these little tiny steps outlined, thought through... like, just seeing the specificity that goes into the early phases of thinking about every aspect of building a game. Like, how someone goes through a piece of glass, someone had to talk through that. Like, how are we doing it? Are we doing it like the old game? Or are we changing it? And why are we changing it?
Someone had to say, like, in the old game, you had to punch somebody until they got dizzy, grab them, and then take them to a big pane of glass and throw them through it. That's cool, but it's not as cool. Like, when I watch Jackie Chan movies, when I watch martial arts movies, sometimes he does a roundhouse kick, and it knocks someone through the pane of glass. We want to do that also. And, like, being able to see that someone made that decision. Or there's a document that we had that was, like, the kind of, like, open world NPC behaviors, where it was like, okay, the thing that we want to introduce in this is super important is, like, a set of working class NPCs. We want there to be people who are taking care of the world, who are janitorial, who are in the service industry. We want them to all have a whole set of unique animations. Like, someone sat down and said, that's a priority for us this time around. We already have people walking around and shopping and stuff. We want there to be this feeling that this is a world that's being lived in and taken care of by this blue-collar set of workers. And, like, awesome. Like, that's a really cool, not like, I'm not saying awesome that's like a good thing. I mean, it is also a cool good thing, but awesome that we have that insight into that's how those decisions can get made. It's one way that those decisions can get made is that at the high level, someone can say, like, we're prioritizing this. What goes into that? How many animations do we need? How many NPCs do we need? What's the case we're trying to make for why we need the budget to approve that? Like, all that stuff is fascinating to me. And it's great to be able to look inside of that world a little bit.
As somebody who's go ahead, Patrick. I was just say, as somebody who's been looking a lot into sort of the Deus Ex design documents that were leaked the week before, it's been fascinating and instructive to see how much of a game design document on this high level, on this sort of AAA level. I use game design documents in a class I teach now, but these Wei bigger games, how much of it is sort of getting buy-in and selling the ideas to not only the people on the team, but also the people who need to, approve budgets and things like that. It's
totally
really just been so instructive to take a look.
That's the thing, is like these docs were a pitch to Square Enix.
Yes.
And so there's lots of like great stuff about the Wei in which you should imagine the world looking and the sort of touchstones, the kind of like pop culture touchstones. There's a lot of pictures of Blade Runner in these documents. Which is cool. I'm just like, oh, cool. Like, this is the thing that they're trying to evoke. This is the space that they want to evoke. This is the attitude. And you could definitely tell that there are parts where it feels like, or you can't definitely tell, but to me, it seems like there are parts where it's like, okay, this is the pitch we're making. Like, we have to go all in on this pitch. Of course, this stuff could get scaled back. Like, there are different versions of the... As someone who's recently gone through pushing a big project through, when you do that, you kind of say, okay, what are the different budgets we're ready to work with? Like, let's do the I think internally, like the nomenclature we were using for the 72-hour live stream was there was the cheeseburger deluxe, which was like everything we get to do. We want to do everything. We want to have cool guests. We want it to look gorgeous. And then there was like just the fries at the bottom, right? Which is just like, also, this was before it was sponsored by Carl's Jr. We had that nomenclature like a month before Carl's Jr. Into the picture.
You know, Carl knew somehow.
So yeah, that is really cool to see the kind of flexibility, or even just like, oh, right, like the person who's doing the cinematics might have a different idea of what is needed than the person who's doing the open world design, than the person who's doing the co-op design. And I don't know, I like, one of the things I hope we're able to do over the next, you know, for as long as there is a waypoint, is to shine light into the development process and to make it clear that making games takes a bunch of people working their fucking asses off. And so, like, this is...
And they're all good at different things, and they're all bringing such different perspectives to what is being made. So, yeah.
Absolutely. So, anybody else have anything to say about Sleeping Dogs 2, Patrick?
I did like that, speaking of like granular details, looking into these documents and watching someone outline how an NPC would go into a bathroom and take a piss.
Is that one of the things in there?
There is a sequence in there. I don't know if it's in the documents we're releasing. Because again, we've literally accessed to hundreds, and we tried to pick sort of ones that, you know, best served giving people a glimpse into what it looks like when people formalize in written words how
no one
how
needs
you
to see
the
call sheet for when the motion capture people were going to go in to record
but there's one that like outlines like here's what NPCs could do, and there's like a little graphic of like NPC walks in, NPC goes up to toilet, NPC pisses in toilet, like NPC washes hands, NPC leaves bathroom,
right?
And it's like, right, okay, if you want to do that, someone has to like sit
at a computer and write it down. They just spend 20 minutes like, okay, what, and then they have to like leave, then come back like, oh shit, I completely forgot they have to close the door to the toilet, of course, or whatever, right? Like there's always a thing, there's always a, like everything takes people, it's all people, man.
There's so many
people. I love it. I love that stuff so much. So thanks so much, Patrick, obviously, for doing the reporting on this.
Sure.
You can check that out at waypoint.vice.com. It should be the top story today, and you know, probably tomorrow we'll keep it up there as the big lead. If you haven't heard me say it already yesterday, have a good holiday this week, everybody. I hope you enjoy it. I hope it doesn't get too rough at the old Thanksgiving table. For those of us listening in Thanksgiving. For those of us listening to Thanksgivingville.
Did Trump rename it Thanksgiving? Is that what our country's called now?
That's it. We live in Thanksgiving. Everything changed.
Yep.
Gotta give thanks all the time.
Yay.
Keep the thanks in Thanksgiving, Patrick. So have a good Thanksgiving if you're in the States. If you're international, have a good Thursday and Friday and other days this week. Our content will be a little bit... Our content will be a little bit slim this week because of the holiday week. But we'll still have some stuff coming, so tune into that. We will have a podcast on Friday because, after all, it's a Friday and you need to hear us. You need us in your ears. So tune back in for that. You can find me at Austin_Walker on Twitter. Patrick, where can people find you?
You can find me at Patrick Klopik on Twitter.
And Danielle.
I am Danielle R.I. on Twitter.
And shout outs to whoever ends up editing this podcast. This little mini cast, probably you, Danielle.
Probably me.
shout outs to everybody who helped make this story happen. It took a lot of people to work out the details of this sort of reporting. So thanks to everybody who I spoke to. There's a car outside honking. No shout outs to that car. Join us again on Friday, where you can hear us talk about your letters that you sent in. It's fun. It'll be a fun letter cast. All right. Peace.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.